We had breakfast, I think it was Saturday morning together, and I did talk to her quite a few times on the phone, and she's just such a dear lady. And besides having in common our program of Al-Anon, we also have one other common that a lot of people don't share, one thing in common, and that is we just love the warm weather. We don't care how hot it is. We don't care how humid it is. We just love it. And it really bothers us to hear after all the hard winters we have, you know, people after a couple of days of the warm weather complaining. And she just is such a dear. And so with no further time wasted, I'd like to present Norma M. from Charlestown, Massachusetts. Hi, everybody. I am Norma McGann, and my home group is the Charlestown Family Group. And I want to start by mentioning something that I do, and I hear a lot of people do it, and I've been trying recently to break myself of the habit. You know, I say I am in the program, she is in the program, he is in the program. I'm in a fellowship. I'm in a worldwide fellowship. And my fellowship has a program of recovery. And I'm trying to remember when I speak to remember that, because I think the fellowship part, getting together, the fellowship is so important. And I want to give you a little history, because some of the history books of early American history aren't quite accurate. Charlestown is a part of Boston. It's a section of Boston. And it's the section of Boston where the Battle of Bunker Hill was fought. And I'm here to tell you about some of the other battles that were fought. And you won't read about them, but I know they were fought because I started most of them. You know, one of our early meeting places, and some of those early meeting places were pretty grungy, but this was the American Legion Hall, and around three sides of the room there was a big mural depicting the Battle of Bunker Hill. And I took a newcomer to her first meeting one night, and she sat and she looked all around. She said, "My God, that looks like my kitchen at supper time." I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I had not seen alcohol abused. I grew up in a nice, warm, loving family. I was born and brought up originally in Florida. And I had the privilege of living next door to my grandparents and three unmarried aunts and an uncle. And I was the only grandchild. It's a rough way to grow. It really is. Right from the very beginning, I have to say that I was very badly spoiled. I learned early on how to manipulate people. My parents tried very hard to be good parents, but there was always somebody across the street who would get me what I wanted. As a young teenager, young person growing up, I was very outgoing. I was a people person. I was involved in things. I had fun. I had a nice childhood, nice adolescence. Graduated from high school, went into college, and continued just being involved with people, loving every minute of it. And during those years, I really didn't think about marriage. I didn't have any idea of the kind of person I might marry. And I guess I got to tell you, after I got married, there were times I didn't think much of it either. I think had I consciously been looking for someone, it probably would be somebody that I could manage, that I could control, that I could manipulate. You know, I don't think it's a coincidence that some of us marry the people we do.
I'm sure I was looking for somebody who would be dependent on me. And in time, I met a nice young man, and eventually we decided to get married. And we had the same hopes and dreams for the future that I'm sure all of us have had. I was immature enough. I had never seen any arguing at home. I had never seen any fighting. I'm sure there probably were arguments that they kept hidden from me. But it never entered my head that there might be problems. I figured we were just going to be this happy little family and everything was going to go fine. I learned later that my parents really didn't give this marriage much of a chance. They really didn't think he would put up with some of the shenanigans that they had put up with all these years. And the first few years of our marriage were good years. We had fun. We both drank, we had fun with alcohol, and there were no problems. And then little things started happening. Nothing that I was concerned about particularly. My father was, pardon me, in the hotel business, and we were in Florida in the winter and New Hampshire in the summer, and eventually we stayed up there year-round. And we got married, and Paul and I lived in New Hampshire, and all the friends we had were friends that I had had growing up. And as time went on, we were beginning to be left out of things. We weren't being invited places anymore. And being my nature, it had to be his fault. I mean, obviously it wasn't mine. I didn't connect it to drinking at all. See, I had never seen alcohol abused. I came to find out that in time, I had a younger brother who was an alcoholic. I had only seen him drunk twice, and I very often forget to mention when I say I had never seen alcohol abused, I forget to mention Tommy because I really didn't see it. My husband saw it, and interesting, about 4 or 5 years ago, I met a man who had been a pallbearer. My brother was killed by a drunk driver. He had been a pallbearer at my brother's funeral. And that made it real to me. I mean, I talked to this guy and learned for myself that in a believable way, that yes, indeed, we did have alcoholism in our family. You know, I come from an Irish Catholic family. Right. There's got to be a few scattered around, but they were kept well hidden. So when these little changes started taking place in our home, I really didn't pay much attention to them, nothing that I connected with alcohol. And looking back, I can remember my husband beginning to isolate. He just wasn't interested in people anymore. He would much rather be alone. And people wanted us to be alone, too. And then Paul said, let's go back to Boston where things will be different. Choice of words. Things will be different. He didn't say they'd be better. He said they'd be different, and they were. He was an early stage alcoholism, and I didn't know it. And during this period of time, he was a binge drinker. And he'd come home on a Friday night, and he'd have booze with him, and he'd drink through the weekend. And I'd never seen anybody drink that way. I mean, he was drunk most of the weekend. And then he'd get up, go to work on Monday, and everything would be all right. Time went by, and the benders got a little closer, and the benders got a little longer, and I still didn't know it was alcoholism. There was something about these dry periods. Now, he could go 2 or 3 months, but there was something about the dry periods that confused me because his thinking was very strange. And I began to think he had a mental problem, some kind of mental illness, and maybe that's why. I got into the habit that I guess a lot of us have done of calling the boss, making excuses, lying for him, covering up for him, protecting him. We had two little girls at this point, and I wanted so much to protect them from what was going on. I didn't want them to hear any of it, to see any of it. And I tried to pretend that everything was okay. And I would save my arguments for after they had gone to bed at night. And I had my, you know, this guy wanted nothing more than to sit down and drink and be left alone. But I had my speeches rehearsed, and by God, he was going to hear them. You know, I think over the years, how many of the good days I spoiled. There'd be long periods that he didn't drink, but my anger was building up. He'd go on another bender, he'd come off, and we could have had some good days in through there if it wasn't for my mouth. He had to be punished for what he was doing. And then I'd spoil some more good days. I remember one July, I called the boss, and I said Paul wouldn't be in that Monday morning because the furnace had exploded over the weekend and I needed him home to clean up the mess. Now, not many people are running a furnace in July. But that made perfect sense to me. I was getting that confused. I had learned two things from my parents growing up. From my dad, I learned if you want something and you're willing to work hard enough for it, you'll get it. And from my mother, I learned if you want something and you pray hard enough, you'll get it. And I tried every little trick I could think of to get this guy to cut down on his drinking. And no matter what I did, it didn't work. You know, I would say to him, now you watch me, and when I have a drink, you can have a drink. And I never understood how he could get so drunk on a couple of drinks. And then I started the prayer routine, and I had candles lit all over the city of Boston. And that didn't work either. Another thing I learned from my little Irish Catholic mother was a God of fear. You know, as a kid, I can remember I'd do something wrong, and mother would say, God's going to punish you for that. God's going to punish you for that. And how many nights in the years to come, I sat wondering, why am I being punished? What have I done? I mean, God knows I wasn't an angel, but I couldn't see what I had done that I should be punished that badly. We took another geographic tour. We moved cross town to Charlestown. And Charlestown was full of rough, tough longshoremen. And I saw something I had never seen in my life before. The little town in New Hampshire, there were no bars. You had to go to a package store. But there were bars all up and down the street. And these guys at 7, 8 o'clock in the morning were sitting in there drinking. I'd never seen that before. The problems continued. They got a whole lot worse. The benders were getting closer. I still didn't know it was alcoholism. I did not even know the word. I remember being in my mid-20s the first time I heard the word alcoholic, and then I had it, heard it as alky, and I asked my husband what an alky was. After a series of job losses, and you know how many jobs you've tried to save and he lost them in spite of me. There was something that Bab said the other night. There was a lot that Bab said the other night that I could identify with. In fact, I told her when she finished, I might as well go home. You've said it all. But there was a period of time, every time he lost a job, he'd get a better one. And that was real confusing. And then there was a time, he said on Sunday night, now, remember, don't wake me for work tomorrow morning because I'm not going back. And I said, what do you mean you're not going back? And he said, well, I told you. When I took the job, it was only temporary. Now, I didn't remember that, but I couldn't argue with him because I was getting that confused. But he reached a point where, in my opinion, and everything I say this morning is my opinion, he became unemployable. And it was around October one year, and holidays were coming. Now we had four kids, and I wanted the kids to have a nice Christmas, so I thought, well, I will go to work. And I'll work through the Christmas holiday and make sure the kids have a nice Christmas, and then I'll quit. So I went to work. And I didn't realize until I'd cleared up quite a bit in Al-Anon exactly what I did when I went to work. And I've told you that really from the beginning of our marriage, I was the head of the house. I made all the major decisions. And none of that has anything to do with alcoholism. That was me, because we did not have alcoholism in the beginning. Now I went off to work and I took on even more responsibilities. This man didn't have a worry in the world. He was getting his unemployment check regularly every week, so he had money to drink on, and I took on all the other responsibilities. But the more serious thing that I did, I still didn't know he was an alcoholic. I knew he was drunk a lot of the time. And I went off leaving this man to take care of these four small kids. One of them was the three-month-old. And I didn't see anything wrong with that. We had to survive. Somebody had to provide. And obviously he couldn't or wouldn't, and I would have to. The new year came and went, and I didn't dare give up my job. It wasn't much, but it was money coming in every week, and I knew I could depend on it. I didn't know whether he'd find a job, whether he'd be able to hold a job. And I held on to my job for the next couple of years. And we all got a whole lot sicker. Things were getting very bad at home. I could go to work, and I could kind of block out what might be happening at home. But those rides home at night on the MBTA and the knots in my stomach wondering what I was going to find. We got a notice one day when I got home that we were being evicted for non-payment of rent. Now, I knew that wasn't right. Every month, routinely, I gave him the money to go down and pay the rent. But I was smart. When I came home at night, I would ask to see the rent receipt. And he'd take it out and show it to me, and he'd jam it in his pocket. And for about 5 months, he used the same rent receipt every month. And he'd wave it in my face and jam it in his pocket, and I didn't catch on. There was nothing wrong with me. This drinking was not affecting me in any way. Finally, I gave up my job. And I wish I could say I gave it up because I knew I should be home taking care of these four kids. But I have to say I gave it up because I was so filled with self-pity. I was doing all this wonderful stuff. I was taking care of the family. I was going to work. I was doing managing everything beautifully. And if he could stay home and do nothing, I would too. I'm not sure how we survived the next couple of years. I know for a lot of it, my parents supported us. His sisters helped out. You know, the day we were married, one of his sisters said to me, "Don't ever let Paul drink the way Dad did. Their father was an alcoholic." And I laughed when she told me that. And now I was seeing what he had grown up with. The arguments were getting very bitter. We didn't have any violence in our house except the violence that I caused. I remember one day a woman from downstairs underneath us, we were living in a housing project, came up and she said, "Will you please ask your children to stop bouncing the ball in the house?" It wasn't the ball, it was his head. I had him down on the floor banging his head. Have you ever gotten involved in one of these arguments? I can remember times that he'd do or say something I didn't like. And of course I had to reprimand him for it. We'd talk about it. An hour or two later, I'm in tears, apologizing. "I'm sorry, I won't do that again." And then the next day, well, what did he do? But he could twist it around, and it was always me, always my fault. You know, I learned We didn't speak the same language. We really didn't. And I became aware of this in my work about 25 years ago. I was working, or supposed to be working, with a Portuguese-speaking man who did not speak any English. And I kept thinking, if I repeated myself, and if I said it louder, and if I enunciated clearly, this Portuguese-speaking man would understand me. And that's what I think I was doing during the act of alcoholism. We weren't speaking the same language. And I'd raise my voice, and I'd repeat it again and again, and I'd explain it differently. He didn't understand. But he could always twist these things around so that I'm the one in tears, I'm saying I'm sorry, I'm saying I'll never do it again. I became very much caught up in the children after I left work. They were my life. The two older ones I kept very close to me. They should have been outdoors playing with their friends, but they played with me. You know, I think I was trying to get from them the love and the affection and the companionship I wasn't getting from him. I was very overprotective. I was inconsistent with them. One day they could play in the living room, the next day they couldn't. They were never allowed to bring friends home. And I somehow set up an atmosphere where we didn't talk about it. We just never discussed it. The only time I can ever remember any one of my kids asking any questions, one of them wanted to know why Daddy didn't work like other daddies do. And I explained to her that Daddy had done such a fine job. The boss gave him a leave of absence. And I expected this kid to believe that. It was very hard trying to pretend to everyone in the outside world that things were okay in my house. You know, I can remember bringing the kids in two or three times a day, throwing them in the bathtub, getting them cleaned up, putting clean clothes on, and sending them outdoors so that everybody would know they were okay. Everything was fine in our house. I don't think there's anything more painful than watching somebody you love destroy themselves. And it kept going down and going down. And no matter how hard I worked, no matter how hard I tried, it didn't get better. And I was not one to go out asking for outside help. I had learned as a kid, you have a problem, you keep it within the four walls of your house, and you don't let anybody know about it. The one place we had always turned if we needed something was to the priest. But I couldn't go to our priest with this problem because I had heard him one Sunday morning talk about these terrible, terrible drunks that don't take care of their family. And I couldn't go let him know that I was married to one of them. I thought about leaving. I remember I sat up all one night trying to make this decision. And if I left, he'd probably die, and that would be my fault. I'd have that on my conscience for the rest of my life. And if he died, I mean, if I left, that would be an indication that I was a failure as a wife and a mother. What kind of a woman was I that I couldn't keep my husband sober? So I stayed. I did go to a doctor. And I didn't tell him the whole truth. Now, I've got to tell you, this is back a little over 30 years ago that I went to this man, when doctors knew even less than they know today about alcoholism. What I wanted was a hospital where they'd give him the kind of psychiatric help that I had diagnosed he needed, where they'd get him off booze, however doctors did that. But it had to be a place that didn't charge anything, because we didn't have any money. And I try to be kind and say, this poor man didn't know any more than I did about what to suggest to me. And first you said, Norma, there aren't any places like you describe. And then jokingly, and I think it was his own frustration, he said, you know, you push him downstairs, break his leg, maybe we could get him in a hospital that way. I didn't think about it. When you're desperate, you want out, the pain is so great, anything, any straw, you grasp at anything. And there were a lot of times following this man down three flights of stairs, one little finger in the middle of his back would have done it. And it's got to be the grace of God that I didn't. I wanted out. I didn't believe in God at that point. I had prayed like my mother told me, and God never answered my prayers. I lit candles like my mother told me. God didn't answer my prayers. And I just decided there couldn't. What kind of a God would let a woman and four little kids suffer the way we were? There couldn't be a God. And it was in through here, too, that I also shut off all my feelings. The love was gone, the fear was gone, the hate was gone, the anger was gone. There was absolutely dead inside. One night he was very drunk and climbed up on the windowsill, pulled the screen out, and threatened to jump. And I honestly didn't care. I was sitting with my back to the window, and I didn't even bother to turn around. I didn't want him to, but I really didn't care. It would have been a way out. Tried to talk to him still about cutting down on his drinking. Never entered my mind to suggest that he might stop drinking. I didn't know anything about what I was dealing with. The day came that Paul began to demand that I do something. See, again, I'd always been the problem solver. I was the one who handled everything. And I knew somehow this was something I couldn't do. I had tried everything. You know, you get what you need when you're ready for it. And in through here, I remembered some people that were in something called Alcoholics Anonymous. And we had met them years before. I didn't remember much of what they said except one thing, and I screwed that up. I thought they said they stopped drinking for one day. Apparently they had been talking about one day at a time, and I thought, well, I knew it would take more than one day for this guy. I mean, he was in bad shape. But if I could get him with them, maybe they'd straighten him out. And I made a phone call and got some AA people to come to the house. The night before they were coming, Paul went to an AA meeting. He went out to the bar, actually, and he did all his drinking at home. And this was July. He went into the bar with his big heavy top coat on, and he kept ordering beer and jamming it in all the pockets in the top coat. And then he stopped off at the AA meeting. And when he got home, he told me where he'd been. And I was overjoyed. I thought that was wonderful. He said, Norma, there's nothing there but a bunch of drunks. You don't want me associating with them, do you? The next night, the two AA men came to the house. And that's one of the most beautiful nights that I can ever remember. Those guys stayed, I don't know, 5 or 6 hours. And they talked about what alcohol had done to them. And a lot of what they talked about was what was happening in our house right now. When they got there that night, and Paul was in bed, and I went in to get him, and he didn't want to come out. He thought I'd gotten the priest, and he wasn't about to talk to any priest. But I got him out in the living room, and I kind of propped him up on the couch. And I've always said that was the first meeting I ever chaired because I conducted the interview with these guys. And I asked the questions and I explained it to him. They said it sounded like my husband had an illness called alcoholism. They gave it respectability by calling it an illness, and I latched on to that. That was a lot nicer than some of the things that I had called him. They said people all over the world were recovering, and he could too if he wanted to. And Paul said he wanted to try. And the next night we went to our first AA meeting. They encouraged me to go with him. And I went because he needed me. I mean, for one thing, he needed me to keep him awake. He needed me to explain these things to him. And after the meetings, you know, we went every night. We went to what came to be his home group the first night. After every meeting, I'd kind of get in the middle, and the AA people would come up and talk to him, and I'd listen to the AA person, then I'd explain it to him. At our second meeting in this soon-to-be home group, one of the guys came up to me at the end of the meeting and he said, "Norma, don't come back." They talked about his immaturity and his lack of responsibility. And I got to Al-Anon and you kind of inferred the same thing about me. And there was nothing wrong with me. And I knew once you got to know me, you'd know I was all right. I had no problems. I did keep going. You know, for me, it was a night out in the beginning, and at this point, you know, I don't care why people go if they just keep going. I'd been cooped up in the house with a drunk and four kids for a long time, and it was time to get out, and so I went to the Al-Anon. I would much rather have gone back to AA. And, you know, I still, from time to time, meet wives at AA meetings who say, "Oh, I tried Al-Anon one time and I didn't like it." I get a lot more out of AA. Sure you do, honey. You don't have to look at yourself. You people were saying some very strange things when I got here. You were talking about letting go. My God, who's going to run things if I let go? You talked about asking for help. I'd been managing things very nicely for years. I didn't need any help. And if I did, you people who admitted you were sick were going to help me? No way. I sat with a very closed mind for weeks. I enjoyed the people. It was the first time I had ever heard people talk openly about some of this stuff. I thought it was very shameful. Finally, one night, one of the women in a nearby group came up to me after the meeting, and she said, "I always hate to have to say this, Norma, you're a sickie." She said, "You can stay the way you are, or you can get better. We're going to love you either way. But if you want to get better, I want to help." And I didn't know about getting better, because that inferred that I was sick too, which obviously I wasn't. But I wanted to feel better. I wanted to feel better. So I said, "Okay, Marge." We talk a lot in Al-Anon about we don't give advice, we don't tell people what to do. 30 years ago, let me tell you, they did. She started that night by saying, "Now I'm your sponsor." And she would call me every morning at 10 o'clock. At night, she would give me my assignment, and she would call me at 10 o'clock the next morning to make sure I'd done it. And I might as well answer the phone the first time it rang, or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, damn phone would still be ringing, so let's get this thing over with. I had an awfully hard time trusting any of you. That was a big problem. But she told me I had to try. She told me that all the problems weren't caused by alcohol, by the alcoholic. And he couldn't solve all the problems. That recovery for me meant I had to change my attitude. I had to change my behavior. And I started, just a little bit at a time. The first thing I did was to try and open my mind, try and listen, try and believe. Do some of these things even if I didn't believe. Just do them. Back then, in our town, and maybe you all still do it now, when somebody was new, they would have a lot of, like, home meetings. And I remember my husband's sponsor would invite us to his house, and he'd have a couple of the AA guys, and they'd sit down and work with Paul. And the women were off in the kitchen. We weren't allowed to be a part of these discussions, except every once in a while, if his sponsor was saying something that he thought I should hear, he'd come out and he'd say, "Norma, I think you better hear this." And he'd bring me in. And I remember one night he was talking about the 12 steps, and he came out to the kitchen and got me because he thought I should hear that too. And I thought that was a wonderful way of life for him. I was particularly anxious for him to get to the part where he was going to make amends. And then my sponsor started making noises like I should look at the 12 steps too. There were a lot of parts of this program of recovery that I thought needed some changing. And some of the steps were among them. I mean, some of them were fine, but some of the steps I really thought we needed to change. And she got on the phone one morning and she was doing her usual thing about the steps. And I said, "Yes, Marge, I took them last night. It's all right." And she laughed as how that wasn't quite what she had in mind. But things did start to get better at home. I was beginning to work on me. I was beginning to let go of him. I mean, I thought I knew which meetings he should go to and who he should go with. That early period of recovery was probably the most horrible I've ever lived. I didn't understand the disease when it was active, and I didn't understand the recovery process. You know, I figured give him a month or so in AA and then we can get on with our life. I didn't mind all these meetings in the beginning. I mean, he was out every single night and that was fine, twice on Sunday and that was fine. He'd been a home drinker, and to get him out of the house at all was wonderful. But after a couple of months, I thought he should be paying more attention to me. I mean, he was cured. It was time that we got on with our life. And Marge was so patient with me. Paul was doing what he was supposed to in AA. He was getting to meetings, he was getting active, he was getting involved. And he has said, he doesn't know so much whether it was because he wanted it, but most of the guys in the AA group were big, burly, sober longshoremen who said, "Show up at 7:30, and he showed up at 7:30. And their wives were all in my Al-Anon group. I found that we had a big problem with communication. And I can't blame that on alcoholism. We had always had a problem with communication. You know, I thought we had good communication because I talk a lot. My idea of communicating was to decide what we were going to do and sit them down and explain it to them. You all told me I had a hearing problem and I needed to listen. And I began to think, this AA thing is wonderful. Not only did they sober him up, they made him smart. He's a bright man. He'd always been a bright man, and I never paid any attention to him. So I had to work real hard at listening. One of my biggest struggles was with a higher power, because I had long since given up the God that I had. And the God that I had been given by my parents wasn't the kind of higher power you people were talking about. And Marge said, use the power of the group. Use the power of the program until you can find a higher power for yourself. And you know there is a power. It's here. You can feel it. And I could feel it when I walked into my Al-Anon meetings. And in the beginning, that's the best I could do until I found a higher power for myself. For me, I think there should be, this is another change I'd like to make in the steps, I think there should be another step there saying came to trust him. Because that's where I had a problem. I had a concept of a higher power for me. But to trust anyone or anything that didn't report directly to me, that I didn't give orders to, was rough. And I used to give God little things to do. You know, what color blouse shall I wear today? And if he could handle that, then I'd give him something else to handle. Had to look at what I had done to the kids. And I'm one non-alcoholic parent who has to admit that I did a lot more damage to the kids than he did. I was the one who was inconsistent. I lied to them. I lied to them as much as I lied to anyone, and I lied to everybody. I was overprotective. I gave them a lot of mixed messages. You know, I would say, he's your father. You must love and respect him. And I didn't show him a bit of love and respect. Not a bit. The kids were overjoyed when he got sober. And you know, I felt betrayed. I felt they were being disloyal to me because they loved him so openly. I mean, after all I had done for them and all he had done to them, the punishing period wasn't over, in my opinion, yet. And yet they loved him so much. I think looking at that was one of the most painful things I had to do. The next was looking at me, who I was, what I had been, what I brought into this relationship, what I had become. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what I liked. I didn't know what I wanted. I didn't know how to ask anybody for help. You know, when we talk about asking for help, I learned to ask my higher power. Marge told me right in the very beginning that I must have at least a half hour of quiet time every day. And she told me that had to be before anyone got up in the morning. Just have my quiet time. And I said, but Marge, we get up at 4:30. She said, so get up at 4. And I did, and it worked. That extra half an hour that I lost of sleep was nothing compared to what that half hour gave me to get my day started. We did a lot of traveling to meetings back then. There were only 12 groups in the entire state of Massachusetts. And if you wanted to get to a meeting, you had to do a lot of traveling. And I was confused with the fact that I thought the kids needed me at home and I shouldn't be out all these many nights. And Mark said, yes, they need you, but they need you well. Do what you have to do to take care of yourself, and they're going to benefit. We didn't have much literature then. We had one hardcover book and two or three little pamphlets. There was no such thing as a World Service Conference when I came in. The conference came very shortly after. There was no conference-approved literature. And it's very clear in my mind why we need conference-approved literature. We had stuff from, there was some place in Toronto we ordered material from, there was some place in Utah, I think there was a place in Arizona, and these couple of little Al-Anon pamphlets. And it was very, very confusing. For the most part, the pamphlets were good. But then one from Utah would say something and Toronto would conflict with it and Al-Anon would have a third opinion. It was very, very confusing. And some of those early groups that were there when I came in soon disbanded, and I think a lot of it was because there wasn't the unity that we have today. I got involved a little more than I had really planned. I used to say that I got involved in service when I missed a business meeting and they elected me secretary. But I cleared up a little bit more, I came to find out that I even got involved a little sooner than that, because there was one woman in our group, and every week she'd come in with these two humongous big shopping bags. And finally I said to her one night, "Hey, what in the world do you carry around with you?" And she said, "Well, it's the coffee pot and the literature and all that kind of stuff." And I said, "How come you're always the one carrying it?" And she stopped and thought a minute, and she said, "Because nobody ever asked before here." You don't ask questions in my state. You know, somebody will say, "Group needs a GR," and you say, "What's a GR? Give me your name and address." I think, for me, service has been one of the most important parts of my recovery. Getting involved. Marge told me I must never say no to anything that I was asked to do if it was possible for me to do it. And she also said, when something comes up, like big GR or whatever, make yourself available. God will use you if he needs you. And that's what I've done. And I went through all the GR and DR and delegate. I went on the board of trustees. I was chairman of the board of trustees. I'm now chairman of the World Service Conference. And I say that not to impress you, but to let you know there's so much opportunity for growth. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. And I do it for very selfish reasons. I do it because it helps me. Keith and Sue talked about paying back what we've been given, and that's true. But I do it because I want to grow. I'm not the person I was, and I'm not yet the person I want to be, but I want to keep working towards it. I kept active. Paul kept active. Then after a while, for whatever reason, he chose to leave AA. And we had a period of about 5 years when he was dry. And if any of you have ever lived with a dry alcoholic, you'll know that ain't no day at the beach either. For about a year, he became hooked on pills. He worked in a hospital, and it was back when doctors used to get supplies, I mean samples, and the doctors in his hospital never got them. And he had a stash in his bureau drawer, and you'd think I had never heard of a program called Al-Anon, because I would check, every morning I'd check, and I kept a little notebook. Now he has 15 green and 13 purple and 4 yellow. Then he'd come home at night and he'd add to it and I'd have to check again. Then the next morning I'd have to check to see what he'd had the night before. I have a little hearing problem, but I could be 3 rooms away and hear that cellophane tear every single time. That lasted for about a year. And then he was just dry. Towards about 5 years, I think, he had another year of drinking. And it wasn't a bad year for me. When we speak together, you'd think we're talking about two entirely different households. Because for him, it was much, much more vicious. During those years, he had gotten a lot sicker, the normal progression of alcoholism. and I had been continuing to work on my recovery. When he drank, I knew it wasn't my fault. And I didn't know that in the early years. I always thought it was my fault. I knew I couldn't get him sober. He knew where the help was. He'd go back when and if he chose. But I also knew I did not have to go down the tubes with him. I had choices, and I didn't know that the first time around. I did not have to accept unacceptable behavior. I knew how to take care of myself. And it was very different that year. Our daughter was getting married. There were people in and out of the house, young people all the time. And years before that, I hadn't allowed anybody in the house during the drinking. The day before the wedding, I did have a bit of a problem. He'd been passed out for about 36 hours, and I didn't know whether he was going to make it, but I did what you all told me to. I had an alternate plan, and I called my dad, and I got his measurements for a tuxedo, and when I went to pick up the tux, I asked the guy, will you have another one with these measurements in case I need it tomorrow? He got up on the day of the wedding, and he was fine, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and I didn't have to punish him, and I didn't have to get even. The wedding went off beautifully. Our daughter had been in Alateen, and she was not worried through all this. He got drunk at the wedding, and that's to be expected. He was an active alcoholic. But we didn't have to rush him out of the room. We could love him openly and let him do his thing. And he did. And it was about 6 weeks after that he went back to AA, and he's now sober. And I've got to say, he's now sober another 17 years. Sometimes I forget to mention that he got back to AA and always hear about it when I get home. So I've got to mention that. I continue today doing exactly the same things that I did when I came into this program. I have my belief and my trust in a higher power. I know that whatever happens, I'm going to be able to handle it with his help and with yours. We're going to have heartache. We're going to have tragedy. We're going to have problems. That's part of life. And out of everything that happens, I know something good will come. And God doesn't have to report to me. He doesn't have to explain it to me. I just have to trust that if I get out of his way, he's going to handle it okay. I continue to work very hard on the 12 steps. I have to sometimes think things out for myself and kind of give myself explanations. When we talk about removing defects of character, for me, I had to say remove them from active duty, because I think it's like the pilot light on a gas stove. I think they're still there. And I think if I stay away from meetings, I think if I don't continue to work hard, they'll come back one by one. At one point, I had to go for outside help. I had been in Al-Anon about 5 years, and there were some things that just weren't coming together. And those were things that I brought with me into the marriage. It had nothing to do with alcoholism that I had to work on. That lasted for only a short time, but for me it was terribly important that I do that. I still stay involved. I still stay active. I still have my quiet time. And if it means, it doesn't always mean getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning anymore, but if it does, I do it. We have a wonderful relationship now. I can let go of him. I can let him do what he wants to do. I can let him manage his sobriety the way he chooses to manage it instead of the way that I think it should be managed. I think I had to work as hard, if not harder, on letting go of the kids as they became adults, as I did with the alcoholic. I remember our oldest son wanted to go into the service when he was 17, and of course needed our consent to do that. And I thought, if I had him just one more year, I could kind of fix the little rough spots. I mean, he's not ready. And my husband said, you gotta let go. You gotta let him go if that's what he wants to do. He's the kid who, when we were back in the throes of alcoholism the first time, we had this huge big argument that lasted for a week. Because I was saying, this kid is never going to get through college if you don't stop drinking. And he was four. He got out of high school, he went and wanted to go in the army, he didn't even want to go to college. Four of our kids are right within 5 minutes of us. They've all had some Alateen, not the kind that I would have chosen for them. When I insisted that they go, the oldest one said, you know, you can make me go, but you can't make me listen. And I did make her go, and she didn't listen. The others have had one stayed in for 3 or 4 years. This is a wonderful life. You know, I hear people say life is so hard. I don't think it is. I think we have our bad moments. I think we have hard times. But we get through them. Life is great. I can't remember. It's been a long time since I've really had a bad day. I have choices. And when these bad moments come along, I can choose to do something about it, or I can choose to get out of it. A lot has to do with my attitude. I don't have to worry anymore about what's going to happen. Remember those old days? Oh, God, how bad is it going to get today? I don't have to worry about that anymore. I have a higher power that is taking care of me, and I know that today. I had a higher power taking care of me during the bad years, and I didn't know it. Today I know it. I know I need you and my higher power as much as I ever did. You have never given me a bum steer in Al-Anon. You have never given me any misinformation. When I follow your suggestions, when I trust you and do what you suggest I do, it all works out okay. I thank you from the bottom of my heart for these wonderful years you've all given me and the years that are coming ahead. Thank you.